talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. And first, I want to thank Bev Capshaw, who hosted the program last week in my absence and delivered a wonderfully entertaining show brimming with terrific animal songs. Today, my guest is Bruce Friedrich, the founder and executive director of the Good Food Institute, or GFI. Founded in 2015, GFI is a nonprofit organization that promotes plant-based dairy and eggs, as well as so-called clean meat, as alternatives to those items as produced by animal agriculture or factory farming. Friedrich has a long storied resume, including a nearly 15-year stint at PETA, in which he engaged in the behavior of a prototypical PETA operative, staging demonstrations, spraying fake blood on models, wearing fur fashion shows, and other antics that might prompt many folks to roll their eyes, maybe including at this point Friedrich himself. A New York Times profile earlier this month noted that Friedrich realized, quote, his activism wasn't achieving his goal, getting fewer people to kill, eat, and wear animals. The piece then quoted Friedrich, we tried to convince the world to go vegan, and it has not worked. The Good Food Institute would appear to represent a decidedly different strategy aiming to achieve some of those same goals. We'll hear about how he's recalibrated his thinking and why, learn a bit about the Good Food Institute, and more when I speak with Bruce Friedrich in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in the show, I'll speak with Aaron Greenwood, the journalist and author whose latest novel, the acclaimed Your Robot Dog Will Die, has just been released in paperback. The book spins a coming-of-age yarn, set against a backdrop of animal welfare issues, a world Greenwood knows well from years of writing about that realm for the Huffington Post, the Today Show website, the Washington Post, and elsewhere. Right now, though, let's get to Bruce Friedrich with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, email DJ at WMNF.org or texting 813-433-0885. This is Bruce Friedrich on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Bruce.
Hey, Duncan. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals this morning.
Thanks for having me.
For sure. So, of course, I want to delve into the Good Food Institute and how it works and its mission. But first, I'd like to spend a few minutes tracing kind of the long storied arc, career arc, really, I guess, before you arrived at helping launch the Good Food Institute. From what I understand, you demonstrated a pretty precocious desire to make a difference politically and or as an activist very early on. What was that about? I mean, it sounds like even as a high school kid, you had that in mind.
Yeah, I had a fairly forward-thinking pastor when I was, growing up from the fairly early age in Oklahoma. And when I was confirmed into the Lutheran Church, we really spent a lot of time talking about Matthew 25, specifically. Matthew 25 is the place in the Gospels where Jesus talks about salvation, and he basically says what it means to be a Christian and what it means to be saved is that we work to make things better for the least of these. So it's the story of the hungry, homeless, sick, imprisoned, naked, and what did you do for the people who were hungry, homeless, sick, imprisoned, naked? Did you give them food? Did you give them shelter? Did you visit them? Did you clothe them? And that had a pretty profound impact on me. And from about the age of 12, I started volunteering in politics, figuring that as a Judeo-Christian nation, we should be able to solve the problem of global poverty by allocating enough resources and recognizing that our neighbor is the person starving in Eritrea or Ethiopia or Somalia or wherever. And as a wealthy nation, it was, it's our religious obligation to help the less wealthy nations. So then in college, I ran a group called Poverty Action Now. We organized fasts to raise money for Oxfam International and, again, stayed politically active. And then after college, I ran a homeless shelter and the largest soup kitchen in Washington, D.C. for about 6 years, basically focused on directly feeding the hungry and housing the homeless. So that was sort of my, from age 12 to 26, my focus was really on trying to figure out how to solve both domestic and global hunger.
And the thing is, I mean, it's one thing to do those sorts of things as a college kid or even after, but as a 12-year-old, already for the second time, I guess I'll use the word precocious, that just seems quite remarkable. I mean, did it just seem natural to you, or is there something in the beyond the faith that obviously was key to shaping that? Was there something in the in your family or something else that seemed to be driving that? Because that still seems quite unusual, even if you were really quite swayed and profoundly affected by the faith part of that. Just as a 12-year-old, that just, again, seems unusual.
Well, I mean, it was really my pastor with support from my parents.
Yeah.
So, we were having confirmation classes, and he was, you know, this was, there were TV commercials. I can't remember the name of the actor, but the woman from Three's Company, I think.
Okay.
Suzanne Summers, yeah.
Okay.
Doing these global relief commercials, and this was, there was a famine in Ethiopia, so global hunger was sort of on the agenda in a way that, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on what your circle is, but
yeah.
Global hunger was on the agenda. It was on TV. Live Aid was just a couple of years later, so Bob Geldof was talking about global hunger. And this is what, you know, my confirmation class and my faith was important to me then, as it's important to me now. And my pastor was saying this, what it means, you know, this is what you care about. If you are a Christian, and he was the one, you know, he was the one who was influencing what I cared about as a Christian. So, I jumped in and tried to figure out how I could solve the problem.
And
I don't know that it was precocious to, you know, listen to the adult telling me what to do, but it did. It had a life. Long, profound impact on me, for sure.
Well, I guess just in the sense that it's one thing to listen to the adults and be swayed by them, but still to take some of the actions that you did starting at 12, I guess maybe isn't quite as commonplace.
Yeah.
But and you just alluded to it, but I'd just be curious to know, to what extent now, I think you're 49 or thereabouts, to what extent now does faith still guide your ongoing efforts to make a difference in the world?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think faith is, so I converted to Catholicism in 1990, and the homeless shelter and soup kitchen that I ran were Catholic Worker homeless shelter and Catholic Worker soup kitchen. And for people who don't know, the Catholic Worker has a very hyper ecumenical view of Christianity. So the founder of the Catholic Worker is a woman named Dorothy Day, who the current Pope, when he was speaking to the joint session of Congress and when he was at the Basilica canonizing a new saint, he talked about three sort of exemplars of Christianity, and Dorothy Day was the one person he talked about in both of his speeches, and she founded the Catholic Worker, and she wrote a lot. She was a journalist previously, and one of the themes of a lot of her writing is this idea that it doesn't matter what you say you believe, it matters how you live your life. So it's a hyper-ecumenical view of Christianity, and for her, it's, did you try to make the world a better place? That's the central question. Did you live your life, if you are a person of privilege, recognizing that you are a person of privilege, and then consequently, you know, to those who have been given much, much is expected, is that how you focused? And if so, it doesn't matter what you say your faith is. But that is the motivating thing for me. I am still Catholic, and my day-to-day life is still completely motivated by my Catholicism and my desire to lead a life for the least of these, as Jesus talked about in Matthew 25.
Yeah. Well, so I think that's really interesting. Another, I guess, sort of part of the Bruce Friedrich story, since, again, this is your first time on the show, which seems somehow remarkable to me, but that's just only my own fault. So I do want to get caught up a little bit about your story, and then, of course, we will indeed get to the Good Food Institute, et cetera. But in the realm of animal welfare, I mean, it's quite common for activists and other leaders to be lawyers, as you are, but your CV suggests someone who, along with all the things we've already covered in terms of faith and what that meant to you and how that sort of drove you, really prized education and really excelled at it. Was this just merely a thirst for knowledge? Was there something else that, because again, college, Phi Beta Kappa, master's degree, law degree with highest honors, etc. I mean, that's a guy who's just obviously tremendous passion for learning and tremendous accomplishment in all those educational realms.
That's very nice of you. Thank you. I enjoy learning, and I appreciate the sort of, I wouldn't say competitive, but like I like studying, and if there's a goal, so excelling on an exam in the case of, I guess, both college and law school, writing papers that wow your professors, in the case of master's and also law school, I guess that's about a little third of the classes. And I very much enjoy that endeavor. I like studying. I like talking about what I have read. I like distilling it, synthesizing it, to write about it on exams and in papers. So, and I guess the fact that I really enjoy it has allowed me to be pretty good at it.
Yeah, apparently so. Okay, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Bruce Friedrich, a founder and executive director of the Good Food Institute. If you'd like to ask Bruce a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So I guess I'd like to spend a moment or two talking about PETA, perhaps not surprisingly, particularly your fairly extended stint there. Let's start, I guess, with what initially drew you to the organization?
So from 1990 to 1996, I was running a homeless shelter and a soup kitchen, and I was doing anti-poverty activism at the same time. And there was a woman who volunteered at the homeless shelter that I was running and who also took part in our activities to basically make the city government in Washington, D.C., better for the homeless, and also to put the issue more firmly onto the agenda of national and international readers, a woman named Betsy Swart, who's currently on the board of the New England Anti-Vivisection Society, among other things. She works on elephant and wildlife protection. She was also good friends with Ingrid Newkirk, the president and co-founder of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. And I had read Christianity and the Rights of Animals in probably 1993, maybe, and it had a huge impact on me. You know, the fact that these other animals are designed by God, they have the exact same five physiological senses that we do. They feel pain in the same way and to the same degree. By their nature, they give glory to God, and what humanity is doing to them is really just, you know, it's borderline unthinkable. They're denied everything that God designed them to be and to do, and they are treated in ways as though they are inanimate objects rather than the beings beloved by God that they are. And that concept just had a profound impact on me, and it's also a part of the, I don't think Betsy is, I don't know if she's religious, maybe she is, she's Irish, so maybe she's also Catholic, but that wasn't a part of our relationship. You know, we bonded over the fact that we cared a lot about global and domestic poverty. We also cared a lot about animals, and I just read more and thought more and talked more, and finally decided that too few people were too few Christians were prioritizing animal protection, and it needed to be sort of my next step in life. And Betsy put me together with Ingrid at PETA, and we really hit it off. Ingrid has a very irreverent, sort of merry prankster sense of the world. I also have a pretty irreverent, merry prankster sense of the world. She is a very type A hard worker. I'm also a type A hard worker. So our personalities just really, really meshed. And I went, I had one interview, was offered the job immediately, started 2 weeks later, and was there for 13 years.
And again, it sounds like that what PETA's mission was, really kind of a key thing for you, was the way it intersected your faith and some of the reading you'd been doing, and just the injustices you were seeing related to that in the treatment of animals.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. PETA has an uncompromising mission to stand up for animals who are exploited, and that resonated with me as a Catholic who believes in standing up for both people and animals who are exploited. And I liked the way that they did it. I liked the thought process. I liked the sense of sort of fun and adventure that was a part of and is a part of working there.
And so, Bruce, looking back on your PETA years, what would you point to as maybe two or three of your biggest triumphs, the biggest successes that happened sort of under your direct purview?
Well, I launched the campaigns against fast food outlets which resulted in really just sort of changing the way corporations think about animal welfare. We convinced McDonald's to make some pretty significant changes in the way that their egg-laying hens were treated up until 2001 when we won that campaign. All of McDonald's hens were what's called force molted, which means they were starved for 10 to 14 days to shock the animal's bodies into another laying cycle. We also got the cage stocking density improved by about 50%. And when that happens, death losses fall from about 20% to about 2%. So imagine the positive impact in, you know, somebody's life if the death loss goes from 20% to 2%. All of those hens' lives were made markedly less atrocious.
Yeah.
But the bigger point there is that we went from a United States where corporations could not care less about animal welfare, and no major corporation had done anything ever on behalf of farm animal welfare in all of U.S. history. And then suddenly we were able to convince McDonald's, Burger King, and Wendy's, and then Safeway to make some pretty significant changes. Then the Food Marketing Institute, which is the trade group for the entire grocery industry. Then the National Council of Chain Restaurants, which is the trade group for the entire restaurant industry. And so a lot changed in a positive direction. Obviously not good welfare, like things were still really, really bad, but things were markedly less bad for a lot of animals. So,
yeah.
And then that stuff also ended up, there's a direct line from those campaigns to a bunch of the corporate campaigns and state laws that have passed since then on behalf of farm animals. So I guess that's thing one.
Yeah.
And then thing two is helping animal advocates think differently about advocacy. So pretty much every year from, I think the first animal rights conference was maybe in, there was a big one in 1996, but the animal rights conference that happens every year now started, I think, in maybe 1999. And at every one from 1999 to a couple of years ago, I've given a talk about effective animal advocacy and also wrote a book called The Animal Activist Handbook, which really a lot of people have told me had a significant influence in how they think about engaging with people. And one of the central points of that book is that pretty much everybody is opposed to cruelty to animals, so we should stop berating them and screaming at them and trying to shame them, and instead let's have conversations with people about what their opposition to cruelty should mean in terms of how they're living their lives. And a few other things. I mean, it's a short book, but it has a lot more to it than that. But the Humane League and Mercy for Animals, I think, still give new employees and interns that book to read. And so I feel pretty pretty good about that. I'm going to grab one more and just say the video Meet Your Meat, which I conceived and put together while at PETA, which has had quite a lot of impact and been seen by a lot of people.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty good list for sure. By contrast, what stands out to you now is some either disappointments or just campaigns where you, in retrospect, thought they fell short. It's clear from some of the things you said in this recent New York Times piece that at least some fundamental principles as applied to PETA, and not just to PETA, but that may have been sort of almost fatally flawed, or just they were just sort of miscalibrated.
I don't know about fatally flawed or miscalibrated. I guess miscalibrated in that I really did believe for a very long time that because 97% of Americans are opposed to cruelty to animals, and I imagine 97% of humanity is opposed to cruelty to animals, and because eating meat supports cruelty and is not necessary, I thought it was inevitable that we would be able to convince people by appealing to morality to stop eating meat. So I just vastly underestimated whatever it is about meat that is so appealing to so many people.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's physiological or psychological or emotional or cultural, but it's definitely the case that we are eating more meat today per capita in the United States than we were when I came to PETA in 1996. We're eating more meat in the United States per capita than in all of recorded history previously. And since we've shifted from beef to chicken, we're eating you know, something like 70% more animals just in the United States than when I came to PETA in 1996. So I think individual activism is important and valuable. I'm very proud of all that I did and accomplished at PETA. But I think it's not going to get us, we're not going to solve the problem of industrial animal agriculture unless we give consumers the meat that they love. And we can do that. We can produce meat from plants. We can grow meat directly from cells. We can take animal cruelty out of the meat equation altogether. So that's what I'm focused on now.
Right. Well, that, of course, brings us right up to the edge of discussing the Good Food Institute, which I do want to do. But we've had a couple of callers holding, so I want to get at least one or more of them involved in the conversation. So they've been holding for quite some time. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Bruce Friedrich.
Yeah. Hey, first of all, Bruce, I want to totally thank you for your work with PETA and your current work. And, you know, I'm really tired of people slagging PETA. They say, oh, they're too radical. They're in your face. They use women in their ads. They throw fake blood. But like you've pointed out, the tortures that the human species does to non-human animals is magnitudes of offensive and unacceptable compared to anything that Captain Paul Watson or PETA or anyone has ever done. And the problem for us is that the human species is not, by nature, a moral species, an ethical species. It's a very bright animal, and it wants to eat whatever it wants to eat. And spiritual concerns, moral concerns, like what you would get out of your Bible or other ethical conditions like Buddhism, most people don't care. And I would disagree with you that people don't support animal cruelty. As a vegan activist who talks to fishermen and hunters and barbecue festival attendees, they laugh at animals. They laugh at those of us who care about animals. They call us tree huggers and worse. And they enjoy harming animals. They enjoy eating animals. They don't care about the pain of animals. And those of us that do, we're slagged. So I hope that your new institute will work with your softer approach. But don't underestimate the corruption and the selfishness at the heart of our species.
All right. Well, I mean, two things. The first one is, even if all of that is true, the basic theory of change of the Good Food Institute, which I think is extraordinarily sound, and I would encourage people to check us out online at gfi.org, so GFI for Good Food Institute, gfi.org online. Our basic thesis is, if we can give people everything they like about meat, the taste, the texture, and so on, but we can produce it from plants or we can grow it directly from cells and it costs less, the vast majority of people, what they decide, what they make their dietary choices on the basis of, it's price, taste, convenience. So we can just replace all of it. So even if it's true that people don't care about cruelty to animals, our thesis still works. I will just say I've gathered a lot of signatures on behalf of ballot initiatives to protect farm animals. And the first one was in 2001, 2002 in Florida, when we amended the Constitution of Florida to ban gestation crate for mother pigs. And we banned it overwhelmingly. It was a 55-45, sorry, which is huge. And the opposition didn't argue battery cages are okay. They didn't argue they're not cruel. They made two arguments. One, they argued the price of pork was going to go up. And two, they argued, should we really be amending the Florida Constitution on behalf of farm animals? And the people of Florida overwhelmingly said, we don't care if the price goes up. And yes, we should amend the Constitution. This is important. And the thing I found most interesting about this is we would be gathering signatures at like clam bakes. We would be gathering signatures at seafood festivals. We would be gathering signatures from people, you know, who are walking along eating a big turkey leg. And these folks were like, oh my, and they'd see the photo of the pig in the crate, and they would be appropriately outraged. I think there's just something about eating that, you know, it's the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy. It's the physiology. And I think people just, most people are not going to incorporate ethics, but the ballot initiatives in California and Massachusetts and Florida and Arizona obviously a very red state. I think we show that it's a bipartisan issue, concern for farm animals, as does Gallup polling. I think 97% of Americans told Gallup that they want to see farm animals protected from abuse. So, you know, there are anomalies, and I think there are people who are uncomfortable, right? They feel challenged in some way, so they laugh or mock or whatever. But at the end of the day, I think the vast majority of people want to be kind.
Yeah, and it is interesting, Bruce, as a Florida transplant, I've been struck that on the one hand, I mean, Florida's not surprisingly big on fishing and hunting and whatever, but there are periodically instances when you decided one where they're sort of out in front of sometimes animal welfare issues. And
they banned dog racing in this last election.
Right.
Banned it overwhelmingly. And
yep,
they are the first state in U.S. history to ban a common agricultural practice. I think most people, if they can make a choice between doing something kind and doing something cruel, they're going to go for kind. And especially, you know, Massachusetts and California are obviously fairly blue states, but California, I mean, I'm pretty sure it was every single county, even the deep red counties, banned both the confinement practices that are so cruel, as well as the sale of products from confined animals. And again, the opposition, they spent millions of dollars not trying to argue that these practices are fine. They just said, the price is going to go up, the price is going to go up, the price is going to go up. And consumers at the ballot box, which is when they, you know, do recognize that they're making ethical decisions, consumers say, we don't care. These practices are not okay, and we don't want them in the state of California. Even in the very deep red parts of the state.
Yeah, it's encouraging when you see things. Sometimes you say they're anomalies, but we'll take our anomalies when we can get them, if that's what it takes to move this forward. And also, I guess the thing that's really notable, too, about the Good Food Institute is that you're saying, really, or the premise, in some ways, to oversimplify, is like, we're not going to continue the other battle right now because, again, if anything, the meat consumption has somehow gone up despite all those great efforts and campaigns and attempts to persuade folks. So we're just going to give you a reason to eat this kind of meat over here and be happy with doing it, and then everybody's kind of advancing. And it seems like the Impossible Burger, Beyond Meat, et cetera, are game changers in that way.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I just want to be clear. I mean, I'm supportive of people continuing to try to change the zeitgeist. But I think with GFI's work, we're just going to make it so much easier for people. So we're removing the barriers in a way that I think is complementary to all the rest of the work on behalf of a kinder planet.
Yeah. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Bruce Friedrich, co-founder and executive director of the Good Food Institute. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. I'm going to get into some mechanics of the Good Food Institute in a moment or two with you, Bruce, but I'm going to get one more caller involved right now, though. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Bruce Friedrich. Hello, it's you. Go ahead, please. Hello, I hear you there. You've been holding for a bit. Last chance. Go ahead, please. Do you have a question or comment for Bruce? Okay, that's a shame. All right. So I know that GFI does a lot of things. One seems to be helping fund or provide funds for food-related startups that are sort of in the same kind of vein, say, as Impossible Burger or Beyond Meat. So let's say that I've developed a plant-based sushi that's just super delicious and great and I think is ready to scale. So I approach the Good Food Institute. What happens next?
Well, we have a team of people. So GFI has four departments. You would be approaching our innovation department. Our innovation department has, in fact, started three companies from scratch and been dispositive in the starting of a bunch of other companies. And we have people who would, we have a startup manual, which we would probably recommend that you review if you haven't yet. Mm-hmm. And the startup manual came out of the idea that so many people were starting these companies and they were having to sort of figure out how to be entrepreneurs and how to start a company from scratch. So it's kind of everything you didn't even think to ask, but need to know about being an entrepreneur in the plant-based or the clean meat market sectors. So we would start by asking folks to do that. We would invite people to join our GFI Ideas Slack channel, which is, I think, about 400 plant-based and cellular agriculture entrepreneurs. We have monthly calls that generally get 50 or 60 people on them. We have presentations from people who can be useful to folks in these companies and put people together. So a lot of founders have found themselves through GFI's innovation community. And then we also have a way to connect potential investors to founders as well. So that's a lot of what we do in innovation. We also have a consumer scientist who helps to answer key questions of marketing and palatability and what do sort of consumers want as a general rule. And then we also have a science and technology department, a corporate engagement department, and a policy department. And then we also operate in five other areas of the world in addition to the United States.
So it's, I guess it's a bigger operation than even I had thought as of today's interview. So how many employees then are we talking about at this point?
We have about 65 in the United States and about a dozen overseas. By the end of the year, we should have about 30 overseas and probably just north of 75 in the United States. So we have about 15 positions to fill in the United States. And about 20 positions to fill overseas.
Wow. So it's really growing. And I guess depending on which wing of GFI people are in, there's all kinds of people and resources to assist with those efforts.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And we were founded sort of thinking about the science and technology side. So how do we actually scale up creating meat from plants and growing meat directly from cells? And so it was sort of a complement the science side with the innovation side. Then it quickly became clear that we needed to be doing outreach to the Tyson Foods and Smithfields and Purdue's because we really could use that. And this will be profitable for them, so they should want to be involved. And then we want their economies of scale, their global supply chains, their marketing expertise, their consumer base. So we really did change from thinking about things as disruption and now thinking about them as transformation. And then it became clear that there were some policy hurdles that we needed to clear as well. So we started working both on regulatory. We have a team of lawyers working on regulatory stuff as well as statutory stuff. So sort of grew in response to the needs of these markets, these sort of burgeoning market sectors.
Yeah. And it sounds like as that transition has happened, you've caught some flack along the way of whether it's Tyson or whoever. It's like sort of, hey, you're consorting with the enemy or you're sort of gone to the other side. But it sounds like that's really the only way to effectively accomplish what the overall objectives are.
Yeah. I mean, I think for the most part, we've been met with support and enthusiasm. So,
yeah.
I mean, there is a very small sector of the animal protection movement that actually argues that animal welfare reforms are a bad idea, which I think represents a just deep lack of empathy and real care for animals.
Yeah.
And some of those people also don't want to make meat from plants and meat from cells, which is just thoroughly befuddling to me. Like, I just literally can't understand how somebody could think that we should continue to keep animals in these hideous conditions and continue to kill them in these incredibly bad ways, sort of until we can smash capitalism, is basically their argument, which I just think is sad.
Yeah, well, it seems like it's profoundly misguided because I think what we've established here in just kind of looking at your own career arc, among other things, is that it ain't going to happen that way. Smashing capitalism in that regard, it's not really likely to happen. In fact, one of the things that's interesting is that it seems like the traditional meat industry is running a little scared in light of some of these inroads, and including trying to, if I'm not mistaken, limit some of the use of the word meat in some packaging or labeling. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's the Farm Bureau and the cattle ranchers. I don't think the meat industry, which, you know, this is the first time we've sort of had to distinguish between the two, but
yeah.
If you look at the North American Meat Institute or the companies that listeners would associate with the meat industry, Tyson, Cargill, Smithfield, Purdue, Sanderson, and so on, those companies are sitting this fight out, but the cattle ranchers still have, and there isn't really anybody in the chicken industry or the pork industry involved in this either, but the cattle ranchers and the Farm Bureau, which is still just sort of another, you know, the cattle ranchers and wearing a different hat, have gone to about 25 almost states at this point and tried to ban the use of meat nomenclature on plant-based and or cell-based meat packages. And it's frustrating because we are fighting it. We've been very, very active in, I think, about 20 of these states. We have managed to kill this legislation in half a dozen. We've lost, I think, in three or four at this point. The first one passed last year in Missouri, and we are suing Missouri. The thing that's frustrating is you don't really want to have to sue, but these laws are a violation of the First Amendment. They're also a violation of the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution in many, if not all, cases. And we think they're probably a violation of the Dormant Commerce Clause. So we have three pretty strong constitutional arguments against them, but obviously they don't get overturned on a constitutional basis by themselves. You actually have to litigate, which is, you know, a pain and takes a lot of resources. So we're trying to kill them at the state legislative level, but where we're not able to, we do have the ACLU and the Animal Legal Defense Fund and some of the companies ready to sue to overturn the laws.
And I guess it's also a measure of the kind of inroads that, again, whether it's Beyond Meat, Impossible Burger, others are making, because for these actions to be taken really suggests it's like, hey, we're sweating this now, because now they're really coming with some serious products that do threaten us.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think, yeah, Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger. And one of the really exciting things to see is that because of Beyond Meat and Impossible Burger, you're also seeing better and better products from the legacy brands. So I've always liked Tofurky and Tofurky's products, and I have generally liked the vegan products from Morningstar, but they're getting better and better, the products from Tofurky and from Morningstar and from sort of all of these legacy brands. And,
yeah.
We worked with Morningstar to veganize more of their products, and they have, with GFI, pledged to make 100% of their products vegan by the end of 2021. And that is, I mean, you know, it certainly helped that we were there encouraging them to do it and helping them with product reformulation. But that was really Impossible and Beyond, and sort of the plant-based meat sort of injection of excitement into the concept of a veggie burger as something that can actually compete with meat.
Yeah.
Companies that have been sort of making veggie burgers now see them making plant-based, you know, hamburgers, which I think is a great shift in the way we're thinking about things.
Right. And as you suggest, that everybody has to up their game.
Yeah, and people are excited about their game. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it was Ethan Brown from Beyond Meat and Pat Brown from Impossible Foods who got people to think, our market is not vegetarians, our market is not flexitarians, our market is everybody.
Yeah.
And that's just a radically different way of thinking about creating vegan products. And I really like the nomenclature. You know, this is a plant-based hamburger, this is plant-based turkey, this is plant-based chicken. But yeah, it's causing some heartburn, at least among the Farm Bureau and the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
Well, that's the kind of heartburn we like. So, Bruce, we have just about reached the end of our time. We've been speaking with Bruce Friedrich from the Good Food Institute. The website is GFI, obviously, for goodfoodinstitute.org, and there's all kinds of great information there. A lot of the things we talked about in more detail can be found there, and other resources, et cetera. So, Bruce, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
Absolutely, Duncan. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. In a few moments, I'll speak with Erin Greenwood about her book, Your Robot Dog Will Die, newly published in paperback. Time permitting, we'll touch on other topics, maybe shelters or breed-specific legislation, other things that she's got deep expertise in. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner. We'll do so with one of our faves, Joe Zimmerman, with a piece called Bigfoot Enthusiast in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals on WMNF.
My buddy's a Bigfoot enthusiast. His name's Dave. He's a real person. He called me. He goes, big news in the Bigfoot community. I was like, go on. Because I am a Bigfoot enthusiast. He goes, Joe, we found adolescent Bigfoot tracks. They're breeding. Okay, so did you find little big feet? You found regular footprints, didn't you, Dave? Shut up, Joe. You'll see. They always go, you'll see, like we're gonna find Bigfoot, and then I'll be like, no! I was wrong. I should have been searching too. What an idiot. No, if we find Bigfoot, I'm gonna be pumped. You're gonna be pumped. Everybody's gonna be pumped except for Bigfoot enthusiasts who just lost their hobby. We got him. Sasquatch is ours. Now what? Oh man, I don't have a job. I don't have no family. They left. I'm not that into chupacabras. I've tried. Maybe we should go ahead and kill Bigfoot. Keep this enthusiasm alive. I want to believe, though. I said, if Bigfoot's real, Dave, wouldn't we have found Bigfoot bones by now? He goes, dude, we have never found the bones of a bear that died naturally in the wild either. I was like, okay, I have no idea if that's true. But I know we have found a bear. Right? We found a bunch of bears. Shut up, Joe. You'll see.
All right, that's Joe Zimmerman with a piece called Bigfoot Enthusiast, taken from his album Smiling at Wolves. Now it's time to speak with Erin Gluin about her wonderful book, Your Robot Dog Will Die, which just came out in paperwork. And again, it's one of our regular faves on Talking Animals. It's Erin Greenwood on Talking Animals. Erin, are you there?
Yeah.
Cool. So, the paperback edition just hit the streets, I think last week, yes?
Yeah, it just came out last week. It's very exciting. It's the first time I've had a book go from hardback to paperback. Hardback to paperback, and it's kind of thrilling.
That is thrilling. Well, and of course, when the hardback was published, we spoke in some detail about the story, so we can't really duplicate all that today. But for those maybe listening who are unfamiliar, maybe you can just give a sort of brief synopsis of what happens in the book.
Oh, sure, absolutely. So Your Robot Dog Will Die is the story of a 17-year-old girl named Nano Miller who has grown up in a dog sanctuary in Florida that is home to the last dogs on Earth and also a whole bunch of high-tech robot dogs. And as Nano sort of comes to understand the world around her and what it takes to actually protect dogs and also is falling in love for the first time, she kind of has a coming-of-age story that involves saving dogs and saving robot dogs and saving her family.
And there's, as you've kind of alluded to, there's a lot of animal and animal welfare themes and elements to the story.
Yeah, very much so. The book was very much inspired by my work as a reporter writing about animal welfare and specifically about animal sheltering and animal rescue and just how inspired I've been by the people that I've gotten to write about and the rescue stories that I've gotten to write about and the ideas in this world, the sort of conflicting ideas and the good ideas and the scary ideas and how it all kind of plays out in the real world and in this case in fiction.
Because I know many of us, definitely myself included, miss those stories. Why don't you tell for a moment or so kind of what your more recent job has been, which therefore prevents you from continuing to write those sorts of stories?
I know. I'll tell you what. I miss writing those stories, too. I loved writing those stories.
Yeah, you could tell.
Yeah. I feel like I had the luckiest job in the world getting to write these stories. But then a job opportunity came up that I really couldn't say no to, and now I'm on the communications team at the Animal Legal Defense Fund, where I get to do really what I hope is important work, what I think is important work. It's completely behind the scenes, and you'll never see my name on anything while I'm working there, but hopefully people will appreciate the work that this group does.
And the very nature of the job sort of precludes continuing to write the sorts of stories that you had for all those years, correct?
Yeah. But I still share a lot of other people's stories now on social media. So I get to kind of keep my toe in that pool just on my personal Facebook page, which you're welcome to come friend me on, and on Twitter. And luckily, you know, there's a lot of people doing really great work telling these stories. So
yeah, well, it's great to go on Erin's page for that purpose, but also just because once a shelter dog nut always a shelter dog net, apparently. So even when she's not sharing stories by other sort of colleagues or former colleagues, there's always great information about dogs that maybe could use a boost, maybe wherever you live or you know someone that lives in that area that has been sitting in a shelter for, you know, a year or 2 years or, you know, any kind of story, and some bunch of cute, really sweet stories and all kinds of stuff. So, yeah, and there's all kinds of interesting stuff. Plus, you get to see occasional manatee footage and, you know, pictures and all kinds of stuff. But let's circle back just in our remaining moment or two here, Aaron, to the book a little bit. Obviously, the hardback came out some time ago, and as we've noted, the paperback just came out a week or so ago. So what overall has been the reaction among YA readers to the book?
You know, I love when I talk to YA readers because they see exactly what it is that's important in the book. I was just doing a Skype call with the New York Public Library's Teen Book Club yesterday.
Great.
You know, and it's these kids who have read the book and are just engaging with the ideas so much. And they, you know, they're telling me how much they love dogs and how much they want to do good for dogs and how they're wrestling with the ideas in here. And, you know, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but, you know, there's characters where you change how you see the character over the course of the book. And, you know, and they were just deeply grappling with these changes and what they mean and how they should affect their own lives and how it affects the characters in the books. And, I mean, it just blows me away. I think when I was that age, I was not nearly so careful and thoughtful. And to have the opportunity to talk to young readers who just are grappling so deeply with the ideas that I was hoping that they would get out of the book, it's just blown me away. And I think every time I've had the absolute honor and pleasure of talking to a group at a library or at a school, I have come away thinking the same thing, just that these kids are amazing readers who are so smart and so thoughtful and really are just grappling with exactly what I was hoping they would.
And I guess we should note on the off chance, some folks don't necessarily recognize it. YA stands for young adult, and it's its own sort of genre. But really, one of the things I thought when I read the book, and we discussed this in some detail back when the hardback was just out, is that I felt like it was, you know, worked really, you know, beautifully as a YA book, but also that it kind of transcended the genre at the same time. And I don't know if others have noted that or in the course of the time that the original book has been out, but there's just a lot of other interesting themes and stuff there that can work on a different level too.
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad that you think that. I mean, YA is actually, it's a very deep genre with a lot going on in it. And usually what it just means is the main characters, you know, you've got main characters who are young. But I don't think that it means that the ideas that are being promoted or that the stories are less complicated than what you'd find in any other kind of genre.
I didn't mean to suggest that as much as that sometimes YA work is aimed at YA kind of audience.
Sure.
And that's who reads it, and which is great. But sometimes other people who wouldn't necessarily traffic in YA kind of books miss something like Your Robot Dog Will Die that could actually be a great read for them as well. So,
yeah, I hope so. I mean, one of the parts that's been really gratifying about having the book out is just the reception from the animal welfare community, which is, you know, a mix of younger people and not such younger people. And they seem to have really just embraced the book and helped me promote the book and enjoyed the book. And, you know, I was doing a reading at a library last weekend that was in partnership with an animal shelter, Manatee County Animal Services, which is doing terrific work. If you ever have the opportunity to go there and check it out, definitely do that in Florida. And one of the things that folks from the shelter were saying is that they really felt like, you know, that the book got the animal welfare part of it right. Which just meant a lot to me. It meant a lot.
No, that's great.
To hear that from people who work in the field.
For sure. And I think there's been more than a few events like that where you've done readings at or in concert with shelters and had sort of multiple things that would be include adoption and other stuff. So it's been really
dogs at readings. It's the best thing in the world.
Yeah. My God, what a rapt audience, right?
Yeah. Get in touch if you want to organize something. I'm super easy to find online.
For sure.
Yeah.
So, and again, the book, we should say now in its paperback version. Wherever you get your books, however you get them, it's readily accessible that way. So we have just, we're sort of out of time. Sorry, I was going to ask you something else about just some sort of animal welfare thing that maybe was hitting you either positive or negative, but I talked probably too long about other stuff. But we'll have you back on. I'm always looking for an excuse to have you back on the show, so we will do that. But anyway, so again, the book is Your Robot Dog Will Die. It's Aaron Greenwood, A-R-I-N Greenwood, and obviously it's really wonderful in all kinds of ways, especially for people who listen to this kind of show. So Aaron, thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals.
Oh, thank you, Duncan, and happy birthday.
Oh, thanks. Thanks a lot. Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we are just at the tail end of Talking Animals, and at 11 o'clock, I thought I was going to be able to say Rob will be here, but he's giving a talk, so there'll be something else, and then Nola up at noon, and John Gilmore. So it's the Talking Animals on WMF Tampa. Thanks.